headlines. Heavy fighting underway in eastern Ukraine, where Russian forces are advancing amid a possibility of a partial Ukrainian retreat. The U.S. targets North Korea with a new set of sanctions after China and Russia blocked its push for more sanctions at the U.N. Also, one day ahead of Israel's flag march, Palestinian groups warn that they are ready for confrontation as Israel refuses to change the planned route. Hello and welcome. My name is Gisumi Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. Russia says a growing monkeypox outbreak originates from the U.S. biolabs in Nigeria. Head of Russia's Nuclear, Chemical and Biological Defenses, Igor Kirillov, was the one to make these remarks. He said that, according to the World Health Organization, the new monkeypox strain comes from Nigeria, where Washington has deployed its biological infrastructures. He said that the U.S. has at least four operating biolabs there. He called for the coincidence to be fully inspected. Monkeypox is an endemic in parts of the West and Central Asia, but it has spread about 20 countries. Over 300 confirmed or suspected cases have been reported so far. Moving on to the Russia-Ukraine war, Ukraine's president says his country will do whatever it takes to defend the eastern region of Donbass, where Russian forces are conducting a fierce offensive. Volodymyr Zelensky has accused Moscow of carrying out genocide in Donbass. He says Russian forces have concentrated maximum artillery and reserves in that region, targeting it with missile strikes and aircraft attacks. The fighting in Donbass has been raging over the past week. Some Ukrainian forces have reportedly been stationed in Donbass. That makes up the Donetsk and Luhansk provinces. For more details, we're joined by our correspondent, Johnny Miller. Johnny, can you paint a picture for us of the situation in eastern Ukraine?
Well, it looks like the analysts at the start of this war who are predicting that Ukraine can't win this war after being proved correct at the moment. The long-awaited, the long-talked-about encirclement of Ukrainian troops in the Donbass looks like it's happening. And while there's been many Ukrainian units over recent days posting on the internet saying that they are refusing to fight, even from the official hierarchy now, they're saying that they're looking at a full withdrawal. NATO is still determined to supply Ukraine with weapons, particularly the United States and Britain. There's been a number of weapon systems delivered to the Ukrainians over recent weeks and months, which were supposed to be game changers. That hasn't happened. Well, the Americans are now saying they're going to send high-tech, long-range artillery. So we'll have to see whether that changes anything. But also, there's interestingly a bit of a split within NATO. While Britain, France, Poland, some of the Baltic states like Estonia seem determined to do whatever they can to help Ukraine defeat Russia, powerhouses of the EU, France and Germany, are less interested in supporting Ukraine. I spoke to a French journalist yesterday who said that France is basically just doing enough to show that it is trying to help, while Germany has said that they are not going to supply the weapons Ukraine has asked for. So Ukraine can only win this war with Russia with full NATO backing, but there seems to be some kind of split. But whether NATO or Ukraine can do anything to stop Russia taking the whole of the Donbass region looks increasingly unlikely. And we'll have to see then whether Russia wants to take more of Ukraine, the cities of Kharkiv and Odessa perhaps, which have large Russian-speaking populations, or whether they try and call an end to what they call their special military operation there. Russia have taken big, serious casualties in this war. They're nowhere near as high as Ukraine or some NATO countries are claiming. But Russia have taken significant casualties. And in the Donbass, which is largely made of villages and towns, their air and artillery superiority is having a devastating effect. But will Russia have the determination to take other cities, or do they want to? Because it's in the cities where Ukraine can mount the most decisive defense.
So, Johnny, how probable is a Ukrainian retreat, and how far have Russian forces advanced?
It's looking increasingly likely. I was in the town of Svetlodarsk yesterday, which used to be held by Ukraine. Now it's held by Russia. There was no fight in that town. I was surprised to see, one of the few places I've been to on the front lines, there was no damage. The Ukrainian troops simply left that town. There was talk of them making a big stand in Severodonetsk, but it looks like the Ukrainian hierarchy there are saying that they're going to start withdrawing. So if they're saying that, it looks like they are. But will Ukrainian troops be able to get out before an encirclement? Also, along the roads and highways where Ukraine is dug in, it's harder for Ukrainian airstrikes and artillery to find them and to hit them. They're retreating along major highways. That can be very dangerous for them as well, as it leaves themselves open to Russian airstrikes. But the next few days may prove pivotal to see whether Ukraine mounts a full withdrawal and how far Russia can go in taking the whole of the Donbass region.
So do you have an estimate of the number of Russian troops currently in Donbass?
There's talks of an army of 20,000 just north of Severodonetsk. They're saying they outnumber the Ukrainians there at the moment. And they're trying to move slowly because they're trying to limit their own casualty numbers. They say they're trying to limit civilian deaths as well, using artillery, using air, and then slowly moving their troops forward.
Thank you very much. That was our correspondent, Johnny Miller, joining us from Donetsk. Moving on, North Korea reports a drop in the number of new fever cases as it battles its first outbreak since the beginning of the pandemic. Local media say over 88,500 people showed fever symptoms on Friday. The figure dropped to below 100,000 for the first time since North Korea began reporting daily new cases on May 12th. No additional deaths have been registered. So far, the country has logged over 3.4 million fever cases and 69 deaths. 2 weeks ago, Pyongyang declared a state of emergency and imposed a national lockdown after it confirmed its first COVID cases. The government says that the COVID outbreak is now under control. Meanwhile, the United States has hit North Korea with new sanctions over its nuclear and missile programs. The U.S. Treasury Department says it has blacklisted two Russian banks and a North Korean company and an individual. It said that Washington would continue to implement sanctions but urged the North to return to a diplomatic path. The move came a day after China and Russia vetoed a U.S.-led push for more U.N. sanctions over North Korea's missile launches. In a joint statement later, the U.S., Japan, and South Korea strongly condemned the North's recent ballistic missile launches. Talks on Pyongyang's denuclearizations have been stalled since a summit with the U.S. collapsed in 2019. North Korea says its nuclear and missile programs are counter hostile U.S. policies. A pro-Palestinian Church of England priest has faced disciplinary tribunal in London over the past week for criticizing Israel and for what he calls Christian Zionist support for it. It comes after renewed complaints of anti-Semitism against revered Stephen Caesar by a Jewish group in Britain. Said Puraza reports.
What they lack in number, they make up for in solidarity. Supporters of a British pro-Palestine priest facing a week-long Church of England tribunal here for his views on Israel. 68-year-old Reverend Stephen Sizer, a retired Anglican vicar known for his opposition to Christian Zionism, a belief among some Christians that the establishment of Israel in 1948 was in accordance with biblical prophecy, accused of anti-Semitism.
We're concerned about how people who are speaking up against the crimes against humanity that are being committed by apartheid Israel are being targeted. And people and organizations in this country that are apologists for apartheid, that are actually supportive of the apartheid state of Israel, are actually using regulatory processes to actually target individuals and stop any kind of dissent from being said.
One such group, the Pro-Israel Board of Deputies of British Jews, that's accused Dr. Sizer of making public statements that conflicts with the so-called International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance definition of anti-Semitism adopted by the Church of England. The definition conflates harsh criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism.
There's no exemption from their attempt to shut down pro-Palestinian discourse. And the reason is very simple. They've lost the debate. If they were winning the debate, they wouldn't be trying to shut down Stephen Sizer. But they know that public opinion, because of what Israel does and because of the Palestinian resistance, they know that they're very, very unpopular in public opinion.
And it's not the first time this is happening. Dr. Sizer faced similar accusations in 2013, but was exonerated in return for not posting about Palestine on social media. Nearly 10 years later, he's once again the subject of a pro-Israel witch hunt.
I think it's because Reverend Dr. Stephen Sizer was not obedient, and he continued to advocate for Palestine and against the crimes of the State of Israel, and they decided to bring him to heel in an exemplary way. You know, they've pretty much cleaned out the Labour Party. They've got scalps there. They've attacked people in academia. They got people fired in Bristol. They've even tried to take on musicians like Lowkey.
A final verdict is expected in the coming weeks, but what this case and similar ones show, these activists say, is the length to which the British state will go in silencing all criticism of Israel and its apartheid against Palestinians. Said Bourza, London.
Palestinian resistance groups warn Israel ahead of the regime's provocative flag march in the occupied Al-Quds. Hamas, the Islamic Jihad, and other Palestinian groups say they would retaliate if Israel does not change the planned route of the parade and tries to approach Al-Aqsa Mosque. People's Youth Movement in Al-Quds say that it wants Sunday to be remembered as Palestinian Flag Day by raising the national flag on every house, square, and street. Zionist groups hold annual events to commemorate the occupation of the Old City and other Palestinian neighborhoods in 1967. A rally last year ended with Israeli crackdown and retaliatory rocket attacks by Hamas that led to an 11-day war on Gaza. Regime officials say a series of raids and arrests are expected across the occupied territories ahead of the planned march. A key member of the Japanese Red Army, a group known for its anti-imperialistic efforts, has been released from prison after 20 years. Fusako Shigobu, the 76-year-old, was released on Saturday after serving her sentence. She was arrested in Osaka over the siege of the French embassy in Japan in 1974. She was accused of helping coordinate the attack. She is the co-founder of the Japanese Red Army that was formed in 1970. The group advocated the toppling of Japanese monarchy and was a supporter of the Palestinian cause. In an interview with the UK-based Guardian newspaper, she expressed support for the Palestinian people and her intent to help them. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has seized two Greek oil tankers in the Persian Gulf waters south of the country. In a statement, the IRGC said the vessels were seized for, quote, violations committed. According to shipping sources, the Suzema Delta Poison and the Prudent Warrior both loaded in a Basra port in Iraq. The latter was carrying an oil cargo for the U.S. The incident comes just days after Greece seized the oil cargo of an Iranian flag tanker and moved to deliver the crew to the U.S. The Iranian Foreign Ministry has already summoned the Swiss and Greek chargé d'affaires over the issue. Switzerland represents the U.S. interests in Iran. The ministry slammed the U.S. violation of international law and maritime conventions governing free navigation and trade. It also demanded the immediate release of the seized ship and its cargo. Political commentator Mohammad Marandi believes that seizing the Greek flag tankers, Tehran is sending the message to Washington and its allies.
Well, I think it's quite obvious. The Iranians are sending a message to NATO that if you touch our oil, you will pay the price, and the price of oil will go through the roof. The market is very tight. There is a shortage of oil, and the world economy is heading towards a major recession. So if the Americans and the Europeans want to make the situation much worse, then they could continue pushing the globe towards further tension. If they want to ease the oil market, then the only way forward is to respect international law, end their piracy, and to refrain from touching Iranian oil, Iranian assets, and which include Iranian tankers and super tankers.
Participants at the fourth regional security dialogue on Afghanistan have called for the establishment of a broad-based government in the country. In a final statement, national security advisors and secretaries of security councils of the eight participating countries, including Iran, also dismissed any foreign interference in Afghanistan's internal affairs. In the meeting held in Tajikistan's capital, Dushanbe, the delegates stressed that peace and development will benefit Afghanistan. They said all sides should continue to hold talks and engage with Kabul to help adopt a stable domestic and foreign policy and enhance cordial ties with all countries, especially regional states. They also called on rulers of Afghanistan to respect the people's rights and freedoms, irrespective of their ethnicity. Meanwhile, the UN Special Rapporteur is in a visit in Afghanistan and has warned about the humanitarian and economic crises in the country. Richard Bennett has called on the international community to continue to provide humanitarian support to Afghanistan in order to protect the Afghan people in the face of sanctions on the Taliban. That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The limelight.
Permanent war has cannibalized the U.S. It has created a social, political, and economic morass, says Chris Hedges, journalist, in an article published under the heading "The Permanent War Economy." Stay tuned for more. The United States, as the near-unanimous vote to provide nearly $40 billion in aid to Ukraine illustrates, is trapped in the death spiral of unchecked militarism. No high-speed trains, no universal health care, no viable COVID relief program, no respite from 8.3% inflation. No infrastructure programs to repair decaying roads and bridges, which require $41.8 billion to fix the 43,586 structurally deficient bridges, on average 68 years old. No forgiveness of $1.7 trillion in student debt. No addressing income inequality. No program to feed the 17 million children who go to bed each night hungry. No rational gun control or curbing of the epidemic of nihilistic violence and mass shootings. No help for the 100,000 Americans who die each year of drug overdoses. No minimum wage of $15 an hour to counter 44 years of wage stagnation. No respite from gas prices that are projected to hit $6 a gallon. The permanent war economy implanted since the end of the Second World War has destroyed the private economy, bankrupted the United States, and squandered trillions of dollars of taxpayer money. The monopolization of capital by the military has driven the U.S. debt to $30 trillion, $6 trillion more than the U.S. GDP of $24 trillion. Servicing this debt costs $300 billion a year. Americans spent more on the military, $813 billion for fiscal year 2023, than the next nine countries. Americans are paying a heavy social, political, and economic cost for their militarism. Washington watches passively as the U.S. rots, morally, politically, economically, and physically, while other countries extract themselves from the tyranny of the U.S. dollar and the International Society for Worldwide Interbank Financial Telecommunication, SWIFT, a messaging network banks and other financial institutions use to send and receive information, such as money transfer instructions. Once the U.S. dollar is no longer the world's reserve currency, once there is an alternative to SWIFT, it will precipitate an internal economic collapse. It will force the immediate contraction of the U.S. empire, shuttering most of it, nearly 800 overseas military installations. It will signal the death of Pax Americana. Democrat or Republican, it does not matter. War is the raison d'etre of the state. Extravagant military expenditures are justified in the name of national security. The nearly $40 billion allocated for Ukraine, most of it going into the hands of weapons manufacturers such as Raytheon Technologies, General Dynamics, Northrop Grumman, BAE Systems, Lockheed Martin, and Boeing, is only the beginning. Military strategists who say the war will be long and protracted are talking about infusions of $4 or $5 billion in military aid a month to Ukraine. Americans face existential threats, but these do not count. The proposed budget for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, in fiscal year 2023 is $10.675 billion. The proposed budget for the Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, is $11.881 billion. Ukraine alone gets more than double that amount. Pandemics and the climate emergency are afterthoughts. War is all that matters in the United States of America. This is a recipe for collective suicide. There were three restraints to the avarice and bloodlust of the permanent war economy that no longer exist. The first was the old liberal wing of the Democratic Party led by politicians such as Senator George McGovern, Senator Eugene McCarthy, and Senator J. William Fulbright, who wrote the Pentagon propaganda machine. The self-identified progressives, a pitiful minority in Congress today from Barbara Lee, who was the single vote in the House and the Senate opposing a broad open-ended authorization allowing the president to wage war in Afghanistan or anywhere else, to Ilhan Omar, now dutifully line up to fund the latest proxy war. The second restraint was on independent media and academia, including journalists such as I.F. Stone and Neil Sheehan, along with scholars such as Seymour Melman, author of The Permanent War Economy and Pentagon Capitalism, The Political Economy of War. Third, and perhaps most important, was an organized anti-war movement led by religious leaders such as Dorothy Day, Martin Luther King Jr., and Phil and Dan Berrigan, as well as groups such as the Students for a Democratic Society, SDS. They understood that unchecked militarism was a fatal disease. None of these opposition forces, which did not reverse the permanent war economy but curbed its excesses, now exist. The two ruling parties have been bought by corporations, especially military contractors. The press is anemic and obsequious to the war industry. Propagandists for permanent war, largely from right-wing think tanks lavishly funded by the war industry along with former military and intelligence officials, are exclusively quoted or interviewed as military experts. NBC's Meet the Press aired a segment on May 13th where officials from Center for New American Security, CNAS, simulated what a war with China or Taiwan might look like. The co-founder of CNAS, Michelle Flourney, who appeared in the Meet the Press war game segment and was considered by Biden to run the Pentagon, wrote in 2020 in Foreign Affairs that the U.S. needs to develop the capacity and capability to credibly threaten to sink all of China's military vessels, submarines, and merchant ships in the South China Sea within 72 hours, unquote. The handful of anti-militarists and critics of empire from the left, such as Noam Chomsky, and the right, such as Ron Paul, have been declared persona non grata by a compliant media. The liberal class has retreated into boutique activism, where issues of class, capitalism, and militarism are jettisoned for cancel culture, multiculturalism, and identity politics. Liberals are cheerleading the tension and crisis in Ukraine. At least the inception of the war with Iraq saw them join significant street protests. The new conservatives and liberal interventionists chant in unison for war. Biden has appointed those warmongers whose attitude to nuclear war is terrifyingly cavalier to run the Pentagon, the National Security Council, and the U.S. State Department. Biden has appointed these warmongers whose attitude to nuclear war is terrifyingly cavalier to run the Pentagon, the National Security Council, and the U.S. State Department. Since all people do is war, all proposed solutions are military in the United States. This military adventurism accelerates the decline, the defeat in Vietnam, and the squandering of $8 trillion in futile wars in the West Asia-North Africa region illustrate. War and sanctions, it is believed, will cripple countries rich in gas, oil, and natural resources. War or the threat of war will curb the growing economic and military clout. These are demented and dangerous fantasies perpetrated by a ruling class that has severed itself from reality. No longer able to salvage their own society and economy, they seek to destroy those of their global competitors. Once the militaries cripple countries, the plan goes they will focus military aggression on the Indo-Pacific, dominating what Hillary Clinton, as Secretary of State, referring to the Pacific, called the American Sea. You cannot talk about war without talking about markets. The United States, whose growth rate has fallen to below 2%, while China's growth rate is 8.1%, has turned to military aggression to bolster its sagging economy.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The Iranian Foreign Minister, while in Davos, Switzerland, appearing at the World Economic Forum, made Iran's case when it came to the JCPOA. First, he said that an agreement on the Iran deal is possible if the U.S. makes a realistic decision. Is the U.S. ready to make a realistic decision? And what does a realistic decision even mean? Well, in this edition of The Spotlight, we'll try to find out what that means. We will take a look at why the U.S. continues a maximum pressure policy and things like sanctions to have incurred on Iran, including ship confiscations, and yet it does not want to deem the deal to be dead. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Former UN Weapons Inspector Scott Ritter joins us from Bethlehem, New York. Also joining us, political analyst Said Mostafa Khoshesh, who joins us from Tehran.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. I'm going to first start with you, Mostafa Khoshesh, because I'd like to understand what Iran's foreign minister meant when he said, quote, now we have reached a point during the negotiations that if the American side makes a realistic decision, an agreement would be within reach. I'm curious as to what you think he means by that realistic decision referral.
Hello, and thanks for having me. Well, this has been the case for the past 2-3 months. Before the Russians raised concerns about the future of the deal, some problems started because the Americans started buyer's remorse on a couple of issues. The number one issue was the red sanctions list. I'll explain about it later if necessary. And then the removal of the IRGC from the foreign terrorist organizations list. And also, a third issue pertains to one specific category of guarantees. Iran has requested guarantees, four types of guarantees: nuclear guarantees, economic guarantees, legal guarantees, and political guarantees. And now there has remained some one or two of these issues. People are well acquainted with the kind of guarantee Iran has requested from the Congress. Iran has said that either the Congress should endorse any future deal, or the Speaker of the Senate or the Speaker of the House should issue some kind of statement in support of a deal. And all of it is because the U.S. has violated the deal. It has proved to be irresponsible. If a deal comes up, common sense rules for receiving as many guarantees as possible from the United States, that's one of the main necessary issues that Europeans have requested European companies, as well as Asian companies, one of the high-level diplomats in Tehran was telling me some 2-3 months ago that if Iran expects us to return for investment in Iran, we do not agree with whatever guarantee the U.S. gives unless one specific type of guarantee, and that's economic guarantee to you and to us, that states that the U.S. would respect our contract. Investment contracts are long, like 10, 20 years. So for the entire duration and lifetime of that contract, no matter what happens to the JCPOA and if it, the U.S. stays under the JCPOA or not, once it is revived. Okay. So this has been requested by foreign companies. And before dealing with the IRGC issue, these sanctions and guarantees issues are highly important to economic interests that Iran sure. should receive from any kind of revival of the JCPOA. And one more sentence. What Amir Abdullahian said, the U.S. should take a realistic look, means that instead of going for, media hype and, hues and cries about IRGC's removal from the FPO list, they know that before we come to that point, specific point, they need to resolve issues with regard to the sanctions and guarantees. They are hiding that. They have tried to derail public attention to the IRGC issue. That means they are just playing. They are not working for real solution of the problem and in order to have a deal.
Do you agree with that, the fact that the U.S. is doing that, Scott Ritter, that there are... Well, let me use the words of the foreign minister, Abdullahian, before I get an answer from you. Quote, the U.S. blacklisting of IRGC is only a secondary issue, nation's top priority. In fact, IRGC being on the U.S. blacklist of terrorist groups, a secondary issue has been magnified by the pro-Israeli lobby. And our main priority is the interest of the Iranian nation. That's what the foreign minister has said in Davos. What do you think?
Well, I think a couple of things. One, that... The issue of the sanctioning of the IRGC is a purely political move by the United States. It has no practical impact on Iran's nuclear program, on the JCPOA as a whole. It was done under pressure from members of Congress who are themselves under pressure from the the pro-Israeli lobby here in the United States and the Israeli government itself. But I'll take a step back. I remember reading about the deliberations of the Iranian parliament in the lead up to finalizing the JCPOA in July of 2015. And there's some very, very difficult discussions. The Iranians knew up front that the United States was not a trustworthy partner because it's there in black and white. They said so. And the Iranians were looking for assurances at that time that the U.S. could be trusted to stay the course. And it turns out that the Iranians were right, that the U.S. is not a trustworthy partner. And it's not just Trump that betrayed the agreement. In April of 2015, prior to the JCPOA being finalized, Barack Obama, the hero of the JCPOA, gave an interview to National Public Radio where he said, issues like the sunset clauses are not carved in stone, meaning that once the agreement's made, the United States will come back and reconsider whether or not it wants to allow these sunset clauses to expire, or if we're going to create a whole host of issues to control Iran. The United States has no intention of allowing Iran to possess a nuclear enrichment capability that the JCPOA says it's allowed to. And Joe Biden was the vice president of Obama. He has inherited that policy. And Joe Biden today, I will just state right up front, has no intention of allowing the JCPOA to reach maturity, that whatever agreement is reached now is a short-term agreement to buy time to force the, or compel the Iranians to backtrack some of their commitments or some of their advances that they made in the nuclear arena, while the United States works with Europe and others to find a new tactic to constrain Iran. A renewed JCPOA isn't the end of the crisis. It's just the beginning of a new crisis.
What makes you think that, though?
Because that's what the Biden administration's policy is. Listen to them. They're straight up front. They are not going to let the sunset clauses expire. They're just not.
Okay.
They will impose. One of the reasons why they don't want to have ironclad prohibition against the resumption of sanctions is that once they bring the Iranian nuclear program under the control of the JCPOA, they want to retain the ability to impose new sanctions if necessary to put pressure on Iran to make compromises and the rights that it has successfully negotiated for itself under the JCPOA. So ask any Iranian negotiator. They'll tell you that's the case.
Well, obviously the Iranian side is very much well-versed in tactics that the U.S. has used. And at least I'm not there at the negotiating table, but I'm guessing that it's a very seasoned, well-informed team that has the experience of the previous team that was there. And what Scott Ritter says there, I'm sure they are also speculating that or using that in their calculations. So how do you go about going into the revival if you have that many doubts involved?
Well, that's exactly the point why Iranians are asking for guarantees that they would receive the merits under the deal. That's why they do not agree to go beyond the JCPOA. They were already stressed in response to the Biden administration's repeated demands for going to JCPOA over Iran's missile power, over Iran's regional power, and God knows the list continues, and God knows when and where they want to put an end to this long list of Iran's power components that they want to harness, that they want to contain. You know, they don't have any kind of problem with Iran's nuclear power. They got a problem with Iran's power as a regional power. That's what they want. They are not for a conflict resolution in there. Iran and the U.S. have, or its allies, they have signed 6 agreements over Afghanistan, Iraq, 3 atomic accords with the Europeans, the Troika of Europe, from 2001 to 2005, altogether 5 agreements. And the 6th one with the JCPOA. In all of them, Americans admit that Iran has been completely loyal to its undertakings. Why? Because Iran wanted a conflict resolution and believed that the other side is there for a conflict resolution. But the Americans had only one major undertaking, removing the sanctions, and they never did that because they are not there for conflict resolution. They are there for their containment strategy that includes using carrot and stick policy in order to slow down Iran's progress in various areas of power, in the nuclear industry, in the missile power, regional power, drone power, and so on and so forth, then stop Iran's growth and then start a rollback in order to push back Iran's growth. Now, Iranians know it pretty well, but they want to show their good intentions, but they are no fools. They have the lessons received under the administration of President Rouhani. They know Americans are not responsible party, and they should receive guarantees. That's exactly one of the major points under discussion, under debate. But Americans do not want to discuss it. They want to just do some kind of media show and claim that the two sides are in trouble over only one single issue, while this has never been the case since February.
Well, we're still looking at officials from Iran who are making a case for this, Scott Ritter, and also the Americans who don't want this to be dead because they're saying that it's still the best viable option. Whether you're talking about the U.S. Secretary of State or you're talking about the special envoy, Robert Malley. Now, Iran's Foreign Minister Abdollahian, and another quote from him that I want to get your reaction from, is that Iran must avail themselves of the full economic advantages of the JCPOA. The talks have been going on for quite some time. Is Iran looking to see a cycle be completed in the midst of the time that has elapsed from the beginning until now? And perhaps there's a test that's going on so that it could then draw a conclusion as to now is the right time to finalize the talks? Are we looking at a certain scenario of that kind?
Look, I think if Iran could get the guarantees from the United States, although I would caveat it, and I'm sure the Iranians believe the same, because they don't trust America, nor do they have a reason to trust America. And America will not comply with any agreement they make with Iran. That's absolutely certain. Even if Iran gets all they want, statements from, you know, read the Constitution. A statement from the Speaker of the House is meaningless. A statement from the Senate Majority Leader is meaningless. The Constitution is the only thing that matters, and the only way to make an Iranian agreement with the United States on the JCPOA, one that the United States must adhere to, is for the Senate of the United States to ratify a treaty, a formal treaty. Anything less than that makes this an executive decision made by a president that, while it may have the force of law while the president's in power, if he's replaced by another president who disagrees, like Donald Trump, it will renege it. And this is what's going to happen, because the United States is not going to give up the capability to snap back inspections in the future. The United States is trading off the promise of immediate economic gain for Iran, short-term economic gain, so that Iran will sign, will agree to the terms that the U.S. has put out there. The U.S. will come back to the JCPOA, and everything will be fine until we get to the issues of the expiration of the sunset clauses. Then the United States will start to raise new issues, and when Iran refuses to depart, the U.S. is going to impose sanctions all over again. That's a reality.
Okay, well, let's take a look at another issue that we need to talk about, because it's always there.
May I add something in reference
sure, go
to
ahead.
Scott right there? Yeah. Scott, that's why Iranians actually worked out a long list of guarantees. You know, from these four types of guarantees, three of them, I mean, economic guarantees, legal guarantees, and political guarantees, they all depend on the U.S. goodwill in compliance with, its endorsement. And we do know that the United States, as you said, would not act in compliance and in goodwill. That's why the first type of guarantees that they call essential guarantees or nuclear guarantees, they were the first that Iran worked and ensured to have, because it depends on Tehran, not on the U.S. compliance. But it's the only type of guarantee that Iran can rely on, because it stays under Iran's power. What is it? When you keep your highly advanced centrifuge machines in store, sealed under the IAEA, but inside Iranian territory, under Iranian control, without dismantling. Number two, if you keep your materials, nuclear materials, intact in Iran, store them here. Number three, if you keep your know-how, nuclear know-how that you have earned intact and without any pause in continuing these studies, then you can ensure that if the U.S. starts defying the nuclear deal, if it is revived ever, then you don't lose anything. You will not sustain damage or losses.
Can we get Scott Ritter to react to that?
That's a deterrent factor. That's a deterrent factor against, one more sentence, that's a deterrent factor against the United States defiance, because that means if you just go astray, if you defy the accord and your undertakings, we start doing the same thing, the 60% enrichment, and maybe we will start 90% enrichment.
There you go. Okay, Scott Ritter, so he's got a valid point there. What would the U.S. do? Would it risk that?
Again, I don't trust anything. If I were the Iranians, I wouldn't trust any agreement that the United States. Look, Iran's not stupid. They've been betrayed before, and I understand the intent of these nuclear guarantees. But Joe Biden is dealing with domestic American politics as much as he's dealing with, international security or geopolitical issues. And Biden is going to, if he's going to re-enter the JCPOA, it's only going to be because he gets some sort of political boost here at home. No matter what the United States agrees to, Iran needs to understand that the policy of the United States mirrors the policy of Israel, and that Iran cannot be allowed to have a functioning, modern, capable nuclear enrichment capability, and that they are going to do whatever they can to ensure that in the long term, Iran doesn't get this. Now, they may make some compromises up front for political reasons to rejoin the JCPOA. Israel right now is saying that, at least some people are quoted in the Jerusalem Post, saying that a bad JCPOA is better than no JCPOA right now, because it does retard Iran's progress in the nuclear enrichment field. So I think there's a lot of political impetus to get a short-term political bounce from finalizing the JCPOA, but in the long term, the United States and Israel, and maybe many of the European partners of the U.S., will be looking for ways to undermine Iran's nuclear enrichment capability going forward.
Well, since you mentioned Israel, I got to get this out of the way. Quick answer, if you can, on this, said Mostafa Hoshesh. Many analysts and headlines, I'm sure, that you're familiar with have said, was the assassination in Iran another Israeli effort to sabotage the JCPOA? Because previous killings, according to one entry, actually took place at times in Washington and Tehran, actually appeared to be on the cusp of a diplomatic breakthrough, perhaps. Do you agree with that? Is that what may have happened?
First of all, Scott, we are on the same page. That's right. Just for the record, we do not trust America. We do know that the United States has never been loyal to its undertakings. They would not stay loyal to this deal. Some might ask why then we are in the talks, because we have paid our dues in cash upfront under President Rouhani. We've never received anything. 2 years, 3 years maximum is left from the JCPOA's 10-year-long period. And we are there to see if we could earn cash in what we've been promised. If possible, good. If not, then we don't, rely on that as our main foreign policy pivot. But in response to your question, I'm not from those guys who believe that the Israelis are acting so separately against their strategic partner and want to sabotage or torpedo the deal. On the contrary, I believe that when they assassinated Iranian IRGC colonel, Martir Khodai, and just 48 hours later, it's the prime minister of the Zionist regime, again, the same regime that has done the assassination, that declares officially that the U.S. will not withdraw the IRGC from the FTO list. That has a lot of meaning. That in a matter of 24 hours, there is a Senate hearing there. Menendez, the senator, and Rob Malley, the U.S. envoy on Iran, they confirmed the decision. They approved, and they endorse what Naftali Bennett has said. That means this kind of decision by the United States has been a green light to the Israelis to do the assassination. Exactly. That is to say, the Biden administration has okayed the Israeli assassination efforts. They've given a green light to go ahead with this policy in order to pressure Tehran, to remind Tehran that we have more options to harm you. Definitely, there will be a response to that. There will be retaliation. There will be escalation. The end, we believe, would not be beneficial to the Israelis and Americans.
Okay.
But American policy is also to be blamed. They are also responsible for this assassination, despite the fact that they leaked it to New York Times and tried through that article to send this message to Iran that we are clean of this assassination that has been done by the Israelis. It's not been our decision. We didn't want it. Israelis have informed us. We are not responsible. But Iran would not take that. We believe Americans are also guilty. They have blood of Colonel Khodai on their hands as well.
All right, very well. Unfortunately, we're fresh out of time. And let me thank, that was Mostafa Hoshesh, their political analyst. Thank you. And former UN weapons inspector Scott Rader, thank you. Spoke to us from Bethlehem, New York. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. For Mikhail Tawai and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is Foresight, a program on how to worship Allah.
Allah, Allah, Allah.
Today's great tip, why is it that we have a lack of focus when it comes to our ubudiyah, our servitude to Allah?
Allah, Allah, Allahu Rabbi, la sharika lahu.
So, dear listeners, we are trying to answer this ultimate question of why do we have a lack of attention, a lack of focus when it comes to our ubudiyah. In some previous programs, we talked about how salah, the five daily prayers, are the pillar of ubudiyah. And of course, this pillar of ubudiyah must be strengthened and it must be improved, it must be perfected. And via the perfection of this pillar known as salah, we will be able to perfect our ubudiyah, our servitude to Allah. Now, of course, in one of the previous programs, we had talked about how being engrossed and absorbed in the materialistic aspect of the world, whether it is consumerism or this incessant drive which is imposed upon us by the capitalistic system, makes us want to just continuously be buying things. And so all of our mental and spiritual capacities are used in order to make more wealth so that we can buy more things, and then we can throw away those things and then buy more things again. This incessant loop of make money, buy, make money, buy. This keeps us so engrossed that when we come to our ubudiyah, whether it is the salah or the recitation of the Quran or the recitation of the du'as and the litanies and the supplications, we are still stuck in that loop. So we wanted to continue this discussion because it is a very important discussion that, well, what do you do to cut yourself off from this loop which we are stuck in of the materialistic aspect of the dunya? One of the things that we need to do is we need to make the transition. So we have to you know, first and foremost, while we are in this dunya aspect, when we're not in our prayers and we're not in this formal aspect of ubudiyya, we have to, of course, focus on Allah at that time. In these non-prayer and non-dua and non-supplication times, we have to try our best to focus on Allah, to remember Allah, to think about Allah, to do the dhikr and the incantation and the speaking and the